Hey everybody, welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Amazing Avenues Minor League Podcast. I'm Steve Saipa, and this week I'm joined by Lucas Lajos and Kenny Lavin. The whole gang's here this week. Everyone's together again. So how's it going, guys?
Good.
All right.
So this week for Promote Extend Trade, it is our first show since Game of Thrones ended. So I think it's topical that we talk about big busts. And
you're gonna start an absolute tire fire in the comments with that dig right there. r/freefolk will get word of this.
The Mets have had quite a few draft busts over the years, so it was a little hard to narrow it kind of down to three. But of these three, who would you guys promote, extend, or trade? And I have some accompanying info on these guys if you're not familiar with them. So we have Sean Abner, Billy Bean, and Steve Chilcott.
I don't know who two of these people are.
All right, so we'll just go over all three, I guess, so in case anyone who's listening doesn't know. Sean Abner was selected in the 1984 draft. He was first overall. Arguably, he was the top high school athlete in the country. He was basically a five-tool kind of center fielder. He was from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. And he always had plate discipline issues in the lower minors, and then they really got exposed when he got to Double A. And the Mets eventually traded him to the Padres. He kind of bounced around a bit in baseball. He was never really able to put anything together. And then he retired in 1995. And just to make it better or worse, I'm not really sure, the team signed him because they figured he'd be cheaper. But he was one of two guys on the draft board this year. And the other guy was some dude named Mark McGuire.
Ah.
Mm.
So it's always good.
How do you spell his last name?
Abner. A-B-N-E-R.
Okay.
Next up is Billy Bean. He was selected 23rd overall in the 1980 draft. He was very well thought of high school athlete. He was expected to go to Stanford, so he dropped from, you know, higher on the draft boards to 23 when the Mets picked him. And he kind of was misevaluated, I guess. The Mets thought that he was more refined than he actually was, so they pushed him really hard, and he struggled and dealt with anxiety issues. And eventually he got to the upper minors. He did okay, got a cup of coffee. Then he was traded to Minnesota, and from there to Detroit, and then to Oakland. And in Oakland, he eventually retired and became a scout, and then he became the Billy Bean. And finally, Steve Chilcott. He was selected first overall in the 1966 draft. And basically, he had a shoulder injury in 1967 and was ravaged by injuries the rest of his career. And was released in 1971, and then he retired in 1972. And he is one of only three 1-1 picks in baseball history to never play in the majors, along with Yankees' 1991 pick Brian Taylor and Astros' 2013 pick Mark Appel. And again, just like Sean Abner, I'm not sure if this makes things better or worse, but the Mets picked Chilcott over some guy named Reggie Jackson because the Mets had concerns that Reggie Jackson dated white women and they didn't want to have to deal with that. So,
yikes.
Of those dudes, who would you promote, who would you extend, and who would you trade?
Extend Billy Bean, I think, is the easy call.
Yep.
Because,
yep.
I mean, did he actually have the best career of any of these guys?
I think he did.
It's between him and Abner, definitely, because the third guy didn't make the bigs.
Make it, right. So, I mean, Billy probably had was actually the best player and also had, like, all the post-career stuff, which is, like, fairly impressive, given that he turned himself from a player into a pretty successful GM. I don't know. Flip a coin for the other two. Let's.
I'd probably, if we're extending Bean, I'd probably promote Abner and then trade. What was it, Shilkot? Because I don't know, he didn't make the bigs. So
yeah, Chilcott really did not add any value. I believe that Abner at least had a cup of coffee, which we know Chilcott didn't. But yeah, Bean is the obvious one that stands out here.
Chilcott seems more like Chilcott seems like he got had some bad luck with injuries as opposed to just being bad. So I think I'll actually promote him and trade Abner, but I mean, we're nitpicking at this point.
Yep, and splitting hairs. I think the most depressing thing, though, is obviously the what could have beens. I
mean,
Mets could have used Reggie Jackson, and you know, in the late '80s, when they were just slightly away from winning, a guy named Mark McGuire would have been pretty useful.
Man, could you imagine? Well, where would you have played him with Keith? Maybe they never trade for Keith if they have Mark McGuire.
Wait, so McGuire debuted in what, 1989?
Yeah, 88 or 89.
So Keith was basically on the way out by then, right?
Well, that's true, yeah.
Player, 86 he debuted, and then rookie home run leader was 87.
I mean...
So yeah, that would have been a tough decision, but...
Didn't they play... And forgive me, Met fans who know history, because I'm very bad at this. Didn't they like stick Rusty in the outfield frequently during '86?
I believe, yes.
So, like, how much worse in the outfield is a young Mark McGuire?
Right, and plus, when you have a guy like that, you find ways to get him in the lineup.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, that was a little depressing.
It's the Mets.
Well, let's go to something a little less depressing, like the Mets affiliates and how they did. Syracuse lost every single game that they played last week.
Oh, good.
Yep, they went 0-6, and probably, they dropped.
It probably didn't help that half the roster got promoted.
That is very true.
half the roster hopped on an Uber to Citi Field.
Yep.
They dropped from being in first to being from being in first with a game and a half lead to third, two games behind the Scranton Wilkes-Barre Rail Riders. So that's kind of sucky. Binghamton Rumble Ponies went 4-2 for the week, and they are now 26-17, which is a half game behind the Trenton Thunder for first place in the Eastern League Eastern Division. St. Lucie Mets went 3-5, and they are now an even 24-24 in the year. And that's six games behind the Palm Beach Cardinals for first. And the Columbia Fireflies actually had a winning week. They went 4-3, and they are currently 19-30, but they are dead last again in the division, eight games behind the Charleston River Dogs. So, not really a great week.
That's rough.
Our hitter of the week is someone who helped contribute to those four Columbia victories, is Mark Vientos. In seven games this week that he played, he hit .346. 345, 538 with nine hits, two doubles, and a home run. And yes, his on-base percentage was a point lower than his average because weird things that happen with sack flies and whatever else. But Vientos was selected in the second round of the 2017 draft, and the Mets signed him for slightly above slot value of $1.5 million. And even though they spent about $500,000 more to get him, slot value is about a million. He was definitely a steal at 59. He was considered first round talent, high first round, but he got off to a slow start at American Heritage High School, and he hurt his quad during the spring, and they had a very strong commitment to the University of Miami, so he dropped, and the Mets were able to pick him up. So even though they paid a little extra for him, it was a good bargain. They assigned him to the GCL Mets to start his career, and he held his own as one of the youngest players. He hit .259, .316, .397 in 47 games in 2017. He ended the year getting into a couple of games with Kingsport, and then he was assigned there for the entire 2018 season. And as one of the youngest players in the Appalachian League, he not only held his own, but he excelled. He hit 287, 389, 489 in 60 games last year. He walked 37 times, he struck out 43 times, and he hit 11 home runs, which is most by far on the Kingsport Mets. And tied for fourth in the Appalachian League, along with Wander Franco and Nolan Gorman. So we here at Amazing Avenue, this crew right here, we named Vientos the Mets' third best prospect of the winter. And clearly he isn't living up to those expectations right now, but he is heating up. And if we look to history, Vientos did do the same exact thing in his senior year of high school. And then he did the same thing last year with Kingsport. So he may be one of those guys that is just kind of a slow starter. We don't really have enough data right now. But last year he hit 275, 362, 392 over the course of the first couple weeks of the season. And then he hit 291, 397, 517 for the rest of the year. And a lot of people contributed that to Jared Kelenic being assigned to the team and him kind of inspiring Vientos to be better. But, you know, it just might be a thing with Vientos that he's a slow starter. But he's having a down year no matter how you look at it, no matter how you want to explain it. But, you know, looking at it again, the context of maybe he's a slow starter, he hit 227, 310, 307 in 22 games in April. And he is currently hitting 288, 322, 500 in 22 games in May. So it's a not a majorly stark difference, but it is pretty different. Especially, well, I should say the average and everything on base is not major, but the power is. I mean, that's about 200 points in slugging right there. I was super high on Vientos coming to the season. I was comparing him to guys like Nolan Gorman, saying that they really weren't too different. And the profiles aren't too different, but obviously the numbers, you know, there's no way of saying that the two are the same. The numbers are just very different this year. Vientos is scrapping in low A and Gorman isn't. But with the signs that Vientos might be coming out of his funk, he's striking out a lot less over the past month. And his BABIP is pretty much the same as it was in April. So it's not like all of a sudden he has a crazy high 500 BABIP or something and he's just kind of benefiting from a little luck that are making the numbers look better. That's not the case. So hopefully he is able to get out of this lull and he makes up for some of the ground that he lost being bad in April and he goes like crazy for the rest of the summer. What do you guys think about Vientos' season so far?
With the slow starter argument is interesting to me because I wonder if it's like an indictment on his off-season plan. Like maybe whatever he does, maybe he needs to mix up the whatever work he's doing in the off-season, or the Mets need to help him create a new off-season plan to help him avoid these slow starts if this is something he's struggling with repeatedly.
Yeah, and he is a guy that is, I guess, quote-unquote known for, you know, not exactly being the most athletic guy. So it could be something related to his conditioning and workouts and stuff. That is an interesting point.
Which isn't supposed to be a knock on him, right? Like, he's, what, 19?
Yeah.
Right. Like, he's not, like, out of shape. He's just not super athletic. He's not, like, quick twitch muscle.
He's not showing up to camp to 50 pounds overweight or anything, but he might be a little softer than you want him at the start of camp. And like the Mets are the major league, they are the quote unquote adult in the room. They should sit him down and say, "Hey, we put together this plan for you this offseason. Here you go."
It'll be interesting if that's the case, because that does seem like a relatively easy fix, or if not a fix, you know, a way to kind of
I wouldn't be surprised if they sent him to Barwis this offseason.
Oh boy, here we go with Barwis again.
Either destroys his shoulder or shows up in great shape. It's one or the other.
First one, then the other.
Yeah, entirely possible. I mean, Barwis has been good at some things. Jimenez and Rosario basically jumped like two grades of speed after working with Barwis, mm-hmm. but also mm-hmm. there's been a litany of dudes who have blown out their shoulders after doing...
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if Barwis's routine is good for just making people faster, but I really question... Because, like,
training
speed...
Strength training sounds insane.
Right, Like, training speed is training speed in any sport. Speed is speed. But training, doing football-style strength training for baseball, not really as applicable.
Right.
So, has anyone really gotten a power spike from going to Barwis? No one comes to mind for me.
I can't recall anyone's profiles, like, radically changing or anything.
Yeah, I think most of the power spikes that we've seen have come from, like, launch angle adjustments and swing plane adjustments instead of, like, pure strength. That seems like a bit of a stretch there to say, oh, this guy, you know. There's lots of other ways to get power increases that aren't just, here, lift this stack of barbells.
Right. And, like, I do think it's a good idea to give your top prospects off-season workout plans. Like, my take on this, and I think this is what most people think, is that if you're investing millions of dollars into these guys, maybe throw $100,000 into developing off-season plans for them. Like, it's not exactly rocket science to come up with that.
Yep. Well, I mean, they barely pay minor leaguers, and they're barely like able to eat like normal human beings. So
they still make people pay to go to Barwis camp. But
I don't know if they still do, but they did for a very long time. I don't know. I feel like Vientos could probably stand to get some speed training in there, similar to especially if you have aspirations for him to stay at third. You know, working on his lateral movement with somebody who's been known to be good at that.
This is something that I always feel can be worked on. It's just a matter of the organization putting the effort in and the player putting. Like, Max Muncy has turned himself into a decent major league third baseman and a semi-viable second baseman.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, if Max Muncy can do this, Mark Vientos can develop a plan to make sure Vientos stays at third, unless he grows another 3 inches and whatever. So
I mean, the Mets generally need to do a better job of, like, have we heard of anything of them being like involved with any of these like high-tech hitting instructors or anything?
Take a wild guess.
I'm assuming none of us have heard anything.
No.
But there's like lots of guys out there now, lots of like different sort of like hitting clinics.
Meanwhile, the Dodgers even have like their guys training in VR, which is something I've thought would be interesting forever, right? If you could pop on a VR headset and look at pitches, that would be a huge tool to use. So
that is pretty cool.
The Mets don't do that kind of stuff. We don't do that to you.
The Mets still use like actual video.
Oh, good.
Pop the tape in the VCR.
Oh, no. You meant actual video cassettes. Static and everything.
Yep. Got to hit that tracking button.
Oh, no.
All right. Well, we'll move on now to our pitcher of the week. And it's this guy that everyone at this point should be very familiar with. And for the third time this year, it is Anthony Kay. He pitched one game this week, and he threw 7 no-hit innings, walking 1 and striking out 7. So, there really is not that much more to say about Kay at this point. I mean, he had a no-hitter through 7 innings before they took him out. He should be in AAA. I assume that he'll get bumped up in a start or 2, you know, around the beginning of June. But anything past that, and they're being just way too conservative and slow. As it is, he's made 10 starts, and he's thrown 50 innings at Binghamton. And that's a pretty decent chunk of the minor league season to evaluate how a guy is performing. And I know the Mets use certain benchmarks to gauge whether or not a guy's ready or not, but you really can't be slavish to those things. And if the Mets have Kay spend additional time in Binghamton, then they definitely are. I can understand wanting to see, you know, certain things out of guy before concluding that he's ready. But, I mean, what more do you want to see out of Kay before bringing him up to Syracuse? He's been good for the entire season. He's been dominant for individual starts. If you're holding him back because, like, he's never gotten 10 swinging strikes on his changeup, or he's never thrown more than, like, 75% of his pitches for strikes, or whatever random benchmarks that they might be using, you're basically ignoring the entire body of work that he's had so far, and you're ignoring basically literally every other sign that's saying that he's ready to be promoted. So, I don't know.
He's not gaining anything at this point, right? Like, he could just clown people in double A with two pitches and have no data on what he needs to improve, no competitive impetus. Like, I'm sure now I'm not questioning Kay's work ethic, to be clear. I'm sure all of these guys always want to get better, but you have no, like, competitive impetus to get better because you're just blowing people away already, right? Like, so you don't have the data and you don't have the intangible factors either. Promote the guy already. Come on.
He's legit given up one run in the month of May.
Did he make another 7-inning start this week?
The last 3 in a row have been 7 innings.
I thought it was 4 in a row, but all right, whatever. Like,
oh, is that including? Yeah, that's including the 20th.
Promote the dude, please.
Yep. There's no reason for him to still be there. Like, he's 24.
Yeah.
That's not young for the
Eastern League. Supposed to be a fast-moving prospect.
He's showing you that he might be who you wanted at draft time.
Boy, I can't wait till we're having the same conversation about Zach Thompson in 2 years.
Kill me, please.
Like, what else are we supposed to say about Kay at this point? 50% of this podcast has been us bitching about Anthony Kay.
Pretty much.
New sheriff in town.
Well, according to the rules that I set up last year, in relation to player of the week, a guy can only be player of the week 4 times. So if Kay performs phenomenally again at any point in the year, we can talk about that. But after that, no more Kay. He's dead to us.
He's dead to us.
Oh, boy. So, well, let's take a break. We'll regroup, and we will be back after this.
I'm Todd Vanderwerf, the host of Primetime, a new show from Vox.com. This season, we're tackling the American presidency on TV. Stories that capture the way television affects and reflects politics and culture. We'll take a look at fictional presidents who've changed the way we think about the real Oval Office.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good morning, everyone. Please, take your seats.
And how real presidents use TV to further their own goals.
What did you come here to plug?
Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
From the first TV president.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
To arguably the last.
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
Primetime. From the Vox Media Podcast Network and Vox.com. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. I'm Neil I. Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and this is The Vergecast. Vergecast is the flagship podcast of The Verge. Every week, we cover the latest in tech news and reviews. We take a critical look at what is going on now and next in the world of tech. The show is hosted by me, our executive editor, Dieter Bohn.
Not your friend.
And Paul Miller.
It just feels like there's something wrong with all computers, though. Don't you think that sometimes?
We do that on Fridays. And on Tuesdays, we have an interview episode. I've been talking to all kinds of influential people in and around the world of tech. We talked to Microsoft founder Bill Gates about his philanthropic efforts.
You can design systems without having to reveal any individual's particular medical record.
Journalists and academics like Lena Khan, who thinks that we should be doing way more to break up giant companies like Amazon and Facebook.
I think in hindsight, allowing Facebook to buy up both WhatsApp and Instagram proved to have been the wrong call.
And we talked to tech CEOs like Vizio's Bill Baxter, who explained exactly how smart TV manufacturers make their money.
It's about post-purchase monetization of the TV.
It's ads. Check us out every Friday to hear about everything in tech, from new iPhone leaks to breaking down Facebook's ongoing issues with privacy to just me and Paul ranting at each other about the role of the government. And check us out on Tuesdays when I host the interview episode. Subscribe to The Vergecast wherever podcasts are served. We'll see you then.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Steve Saipa, and I'm joined by Lucas Vlahos and Ken Levin. And this week, we are going to go back a couple of years and see how the Mets did in the draft. And it's kind of unrealistic to pretend like we know anything about the process or the guys that would have been better in like 40 rounds in. So we're just going to kind of stick to the first round here and, you know, just go over who the Mets picked, what we think of that, and then who at the time we would have rather have seen the Mets go with. So let's go back to 2014. And the Mets picked Michael Conforto, and I don't think that anybody has any problems with that.
None whatsoever.
Yeah, no, he's like my platonic ideal for what a good draft pick in the top 10 should be.
I'm a big dumb idiot, and I wanted Bradley Zimmer at the time because they struck me as similar offensive talents, but one of them could play center field, and the other had defensive questions about his ability as a corner outfielder. I'll reiterate, I'm a big dumb idiot.
I'm sure there were lots of people who felt that way as well.
Yeah, I mean, things like this, looking back in retrospect, is a lot of, you know, things at the time that seemed right, or, you know, misinformation, or just guys have changed in the years that they were picked and then developed by the organization. So, you know, his career could have gone a completely different way if he was selected by the Mets and developed in the way that the Mets wanted him to go, you know? So
also, Conforto got a lot better in the Mets system. Like, he was very polished as a hitter, but the power kind of came on in a way that I don't know if anybody predicted. Like, he's basically like a seven high end seven power hitter when healthy. Like,
yep.
Yeah. He definitely improved in that regard. I mean, he was always seen as like a good hitter slash, you know, like a good average slash power threat, but never, you know, I don't think the amount of power that he's shown.
Like, as a draft, in the draft, he was presented like, here's a polished bat that's going to hit for a good average and hit 20 home runs and move fast through your system. It's like, okay, that's interesting. And he might not be able to play the corner outfield. It's like,
And it turns out he's like a very good corner outfielder and can fake center. And
hit 35 home runs instead of 20, right?
Yep. And the strikeouts, you know, he's always struck out a fair bit, but, you know, they've never been as bad as people seem to think they would be.
Strikes out less than Bradley Zimmer.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the approach has been very good, which I think was part of his scouting report at the time of draft, that he was always going to take his fair share of walks, but let me look up where he is on the leaderboard of walk percentage right now.
Like, he when he was described to me as like Markakis always played good defense, so that's not a good comp. I'm trying to come up with a good, I mean, maybe, no, Bobby Brady was a better hitter than he was compared to.
I don't even remember. I think I wrote like the profile of him, but I wasn't doing Alex Nelson, who's still in charge of our draft stuff. But I remember seeing Conforto like a 260 hitter with like 20 home run potential.
Yeah.
Who, you know, that kind of player, you know, who played okay defense in the corner. Nothing spectacularly terrible, but nothing really that great either. Just kind of serviceable.
But hey, guys, remember that every system has a Michael Conforto.
Never forget. Hashtag never forget. he's currently the sixth highest walk percentage in baseball.
And he only strikes out like 21
this year, 21.7. But for his career, it's around there.
He's had like the most quiet 150 WRC plus ever this season.
Yeah, he's just like a really good hitter.
It's like, you're like, I feel like Conforto hasn't done something in a while. Opens up Fangraphs. He's 50% better than league average. Yep. Yes. Like, the dude's a monster.
Yep.
Good job, Mets.
Yeah,
Well, that brings another point I wanted to make about the 2014 draft. It's just like how loaded that class was and like high-end college talent.
Yeah.
It was very good.
Like, Conforto is currently the third best player in that draft by BWAR, behind Matt Chapman and Aaron Nola. Right behind him are Kyle Freeland and Trey Turner. Kind of hard to mess that up.
Yeah. But Chapman wasn't until... Chapman was late first, right?
Yeah, but he also developed late. So I don't know if you could say that he was a better choice. Because it took him another 2 years to get to the big leagues behind, like, Conforto, Turner, Nola, and Schwarber all made the big leagues in 2015. And, you know, Chapman, it took an extra 2 years. So
I remember when Conforto v. Schwarber was a debate.
Oh, yeah. I never understood that.
It was always a dumb debate.
It was like, okay, yeah, this guy plays up the middle, but he's a really bad catcher.
I have to admit that I was on Team Schwarber.
Really?
Oof.
But again,
I was a very popular opinion during the draft. Hell, the Cubs agreed with you.
Right. I mean, his catching ability was always known to be kind of minimal. I don't think that at the time anybody saw him being as bad a defensive catcher as he, you know, was. Mm-hmm. I mean, a couple of years after the draft, and he's basically full-time DH/left fielder. So,
who's like a 10% above league average bat that can't.
Right, and then he was always seen as, you know, like I always saw Conforto as a guy that would hit for better average, but did not have as much power. I saw Schwarber as having more power, and that just hasn't really been the case.
You know, I'm sure Schwarber would win a home run derby, but you know, who cares?
Right.
That's why we grade raw power and game power separately.
Like, yep, Schwarber has so much swing and miss that he can't get to all that raw power most of the time. And then, like, he'll launch one 500 feet out of Wrigley sometime, and it's majestic, but dude's batting, what, 210? Cool.
Something like that, yeah.
230.
A little better than
226 after today.
He's like that. It's not that Schwarber's a bad player. He's a useful outfielder, but he's like budget Adam Dunn, I guess. I'd rather have Conforto.
Yeah, I don't think anybody is still holding on to Schwarber.
No.
It's like sometimes guys develop. Happens. Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right. Well, let's move on to 2015 now. And the Mets pick was nobody because they surrendered their first round pick when they signed Michael Kadire to a 2-year, $21 million deal. And as we all know, he hit 259, 309, 391 in 117 games, and then he just retired. So if the Mets hadn't signed him, they would have picked at 15 where the Brewers ended up drafting, and they picked up Trent Grisham with the 15th pick. And to date, nobody selected in that middle part of the first round has really distinguished themselves too much yet. You have to go all the way down to 24 when the Mets selected Walker Buehler to find the guy that's worked out best so far. But after 15, where the Mets would have picked, you have the Yankees at 16 with James Caprellian, the Indians at 17 with Brady Aiken, the Giants at 18 with Phil Bickford, the Pirates at 19 with Kevin Newman, the A's at 20 with Richie Martin, the Royals at 21 with Ash Russell, the Tigers at 22 with Bo Burrows, and then the Cardinals at 23 with Nick Plummer. So those are some interesting names, and especially at the time, most of these guys were seen as, you know, mid-first round guys.
Did you mention Soroka at 28?
No, I was just going up till Buehler, who was the highest,
24.
Best guy. Yeah.
Could Brian Hayes also worth Ryan Mountcastle also in there? I mean, there are a couple guys.
Yeah.
I mean, even Caprellian was good enough to be traded. Was he the centerpiece of that Sonny Gray deal?
It was him and Mateo.
Right. I forgot Mateo and then Dustin Fowler. Right. But that, like, he was good enough at one point before the injuries totally borked him. I would have rather had the pick than Michael Kadire, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Oh,
I don't think anybody, especially in retrospect how he performed, I don't think anybody would revisit that signing.
Didn't they sign him before the Rockies had even offered him arbitration or something? Or...
Right, so in theory, we could have retained that pick, but...
If you want to dig a little deeper and be sadder, competitive balance round A, Austin Riley, Tristan McKenzie, ugh. Anyone in round two?
Yeah, there's a decent amount of talent there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that kind of didn't work out.
Not great, Bob.
No.
How do you guys feel about Desmond Lindsay?
Not great
as a either. As a draft pick, did you?
I had no problem with the pick at the time. You know, athletic outfielder. It's a second round pick. What are you gonna do?
Yeah, I mean, it's really through no fault of his own that he's kind of his star has diminished. I mean, we knew that he had injuries, but you just, you know, a lot of these things have just kind of been random nicks and dings that have just built up, you know, and you just can't, I don't know, you can't foresee a guy falling victim to his own body, you know? It's an idea that you will know about and be cognizant of, but I mean, he could have gotten over it in his, you know, second year, and he's a great player. But unfortunately, that's not exactly what happened. Right. Well, let's move on now to 2016, and the Mets picked Justin Dunn. So, not too big of a fan of that pick. Wasn't the worst thing that they could have done, but I don't think that it was the best pick either.
Who would you have rather had them take?
At that point in the 2016 draft, there weren't too many names I feel that really stood out to me. Names that, you know, what's the word? Called out to me. I really liked Alex Kirilloff, and he got picked at 15, whereas the Mets went with 19. And I also liked Blake Rutherford, and he got picked at 18, which is right before the Mets picked. Mm-hmm. But of the guys that got picked, of the guys that were still left, I like TJ Zoik. He's
similar prospect, right? To Dunn, but like,
yeah, he was
more polished.
Stamina, I guess, whatever. He was more proven. He was picked at 21 by the Blue Jays. And basically, he's a 6'7" right-hander, so he had a good body. Low to mid-90s fastball. He had a crazy, crazy ground ball rate. It was 76.4 in the NCAA, which is, like, insane.
Right.
And then he had a good slider. His dad was like a semi-professional, so his dad kind of taught him how to throw a good slider. And yeah, it is similar to Dunn, except with a better body. Basically, good fastball, good slider, and good body.
I mean, I know a lot of the buzz at the time had them taking Will Craig instead, and I was just kind of glad they avoided that.
Yes.
Will Craig, for those of you who don't know, is a bad-bodied third baseman that the Pirates selected, and I don't know what he's done since, but it hasn't been notable.
Been pretty bad since in the years prior to this year. His power was just not really manifesting at all. And then last year, and now this year, finally. Yeah, it finally has.
He has 14 homers in 166 at-bats this year.
Yep.
Yikes.
Only a 116 WRC plus, though. Somehow.
What league is this? The International League? I don't know what league this is.
Yeah, International. Yes. Yeah, so juice ball.
Yeah, pretty much.
He did have 20 homers in Bingo last year. Mm-hmm. Or not in Bingo, in the Eastern League last year.
But his OPS was still 7-6.
He doesn't really make a ton of contact, doesn't really walk a ton, you know.
And, of course, that year in the second round, the Mets picked Peter Alonso. And
the good version of the...
Right. The comparisons between the two of them, you know, kind of big, chunky corner infielders with power. Mm-hmm. And, until, you know, last season and then this year, Craig wasn't even hitting for power. So it looked like a very, very obvious win for the Mets that they went with Alonso in the second round.
Right. It's not like there's a ton of... Go ahead.
I was saying, who would have you guys would have rather seen than done? Or would you have rather have had done?
It's all within the fudge factor for Dunn. A lot of guys at in the sort of like 15 to, or we'll say 7, like, he was kind of like, there was like a tier that the Mets picked just after the tier ended, you know, Forrest Whitley, Blake Rutherford being the two picks before him. I didn't really have a strong preference of Dunn versus anybody. There's a lot of comparable guys that I probably would have preferred, though. Dane Dunning's a name that comes to mind. He made a few top 100 lists.
I was, like I said, I was just glad they avoided Craig. And, I mean, the guy while as the draft was developing, I was really hoping Rutherford would fall because I believe he was originally projected to go much, much higher.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And it seemed like he was going to make it to the Mets, and I remember there being some rumors that they'd take him, and instead they took, said the Yankees swept in. So I didn't have, I don't have any strong feelings about this pick. I thought it was fine.
I think the K pick at 31 is a little interesting.
Yeah, we could get to that. This might just be a, there's definitely a word for this. Crap. Yeah, well, it might just be like a perception thing because maybe anyone who's evaluating their own team's picks over the years would feel this way. Mm-hmm. But it feels like the Mets over the last 5 years or so have very often picked right at the start of a new tier, which often means you're getting less value with your pick, if that makes sense.
Yep. Agreed.
So I don't know, like, I'm sure there are arguments that this isn't actually true and that we're all biased because we're like, man, look at these good players that I wanted that got right selected right in front. But I think this is a case where there was a tier that the Mets just missed out on, similar to last year, though Kelenic obviously worked out.
And then they also had a second first-round pick, and that was the aforementioned Anthony Kay, who, with one workout outing, will be dead to us. But he was selected at 31, and I know, Lucas, you're not a fan of the process. The results have obviously been good.
Yeah. Like, I hated this pick. And I think I've definitely talked about why I hated this pick before, right? Like,
do you want to give us the bullet points?
Yeah, the bullet point is that if you draft a guy if you draft Anthony Kay, you're drafting a back-end polished college arm whose real value, whose first-round value is that he moves fast. That's fine. Like, that's not a profile that excites me, but it's useful. Fine. But then when you draft a guy to fit that profile who you know has a borked elbow and has been pushed harder, has been abused harder than any other pitcher in college baseball at UConn because they do that to their pitchers, you're destroying his only value proposition, that is moving fast.
Yeah, you're basically trading the upside that you could get with that pick for floor, but the floor is disappearing because, yeah, he's got a borked elbow.
Floor taken.
And I'm definitely biased because at Cal I saw Dalton Jeffries a lot, and Dalton Jeffries to me struck me as, okay, here's a guy who doesn't have a million miles on his arm, has a shoulder thing, but hasn't been super injury prone otherwise, and has a similar arsenal decay, albeit from the right hand side. So here's a guy who could actually, who if you want that polished guy with a good changeup who should move fast and be a back end starter, take the one that's less likely to get injured. Now, of course, Jeffries has, like, barely pitched at all because he's injured. Again, I'm a big, dumb idiot. But that's the point. If you're going to take this profile, don't take someone that you know is going to – that you know has a borked elbow already.
Yep.
I mean, I don't really recall anybody else exciting me at the time, you know, in the 30s. So I'm not going to say, like, you know – I would have preferred anybody else other than Kay. I mean, it kind of worked out.
Yep. If you want to go with, like, a straight revisionist history, because obviously, you know, this was a little before I was, like, really into the draft. I basically, like, was really into the system and would follow guys after they got drafted. But Taylor Trammell was picked at number 35 and is currently...
It's like universally top 20.
Yeah, he's very good.
Yeah, so it would have been nice if they were able to get him, but...
But what are you going to do?
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, yeah, it worked out in the end, so it is whatever.
I mean, it's working out, and now they're still trying to shoot themselves in the foot because they won't promote him. What's the line? What's Jarrett's line? The Mets... Or Jeff's line, whoever's line.
It's like, the Mets.
Yeah, someone do it. Someone else do it.
So, let's go up to 2017 now. And the Mets picked David Thompson, who is very similar to Kay there.
David Peterson, you mean?
Freudian slip.
Whoops. David Peterson. It would be really bad if they picked David Thompson.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
So I was not a fan of the Thompson pick. Were any of you guys? Was he any of your preferred selections?
Are we talking
there?
Thompson or Peterson?
Peterson. Was Peterson... Let me erase this on my computer so I don't make that mistake again.
Oops.
Was Peterson... All right, there we go. The preferred pick for any of you guys.
You know, I don't have strong feelings about it. I'm looking at the guys who are taken around him and, like... None of them are really jumping out to me as anything particularly good, you know? Peterson obviously hasn't really developed well. Like, I remember thinking at the time of the draft that he was a guy who had a pretty good slider, that hopefully he would be able to add some speed, some velocity to it to make it take a jump, you know?
Mm-hmm.
A guy with very good command, and particularly very good command of the breaking ball. However, he never really got that speed jump that I was hoping he would get. You know, I was hoping he'd eventually sit more 91 to 94 than, you know, 88 to 92.
Yeah.
And really, he's just, like, not a super athletic dude.
No, he's
just, like, a very big guy.
He's a big guy, yep.
And he already, and now he has knee problems that seem pretty persistent, which is...
Yep.
Concerning.
I didn't really have a problem with the pick.
Yeah, me neither. Like, again, it felt like they just missed on some interesting guys. Like Helio Ramos.
Yeah, he was the one I wanted most.
Yeah,
in the pick right before.
Yeah. I had looked at Nate Pearson beforehand during that draft, but I'm not going to pretend I had strong feelings on Nate Pearson. It was just like, you know, I don't love anyone. This pick is fine. Hasn't been over. Like, the thing I always look for with college pitchers is have they been overworked, because it happens so often. Peterson hadn't. It seemed like his arsenal was good.
He also had a really, really good year at Oregon.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. It was fine.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Sometimes you get lucky with these guys when you pick, like, a stuffed lefty. Sometimes they pop, sometimes they don't.
Yep.
Yeah, Pearson has definitely been the most successful player in that kind of second half of the first round grouping.
And, yeah. Like, he's going to be a big leaguer, you know?
Yeah. Peterson is I'll be very surprised if Peterson doesn't, you know, I really just have to be like a catastrophic injury or something that's going to stop him at this
point. Even if he ends up more of like a loogie, which I think is a role that he'd be pretty good in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not terrible. Like, it's still back into the first round. It happens. It's better than, you know, taking a guy and them, you know, falling apart.
Right.
So
like the back end of this draft, back end of the first round of this draft really hasn't been great. Honestly, after 10 in this draft hasn't been great. Like, most of these guys are not much of anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, not good.
Very top-heavy. Although there's some guys that, you know, like, my feelings on Joe Adell are very well-known.
Yeah.
Big fan of Shira, too. A lot of, some very good high-end talent, but not a very deep class at all.
The top 10 are exciting, and I guess you could stretch that to top 12, because Shane Baz is a prospect, and Jake Berger has a great name. So...
Berger.
Very, like, and imagine a dude named Jake Berger... You are correctly imagining Jake Berger. He's blown out his Achilles twice now, though. So it's,
oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, he's only 6'2", 210. It's not that big.
That's not accurate. It's TLDR on Peterson. I think it's kind of like shrug, fine.
Yeah,
there was nobody heads and tails. Maybe you could make the case that Seth Romero, based on just this stuff only, but he's also a noted asshole. So.
Yes. And they got, supposedly they were planning on taking Vientos in the first, but Peterson fell to them, and then they were able to get Vientos in the second. So, you know, fine. That's a good draft.
Yeah. I mean, it's similar to kind of how Kay worked out, where, you know, he's a kind of blah pick. But part of the reason why they went to him is because they were intending on saving some money and using it elsewhere. similar to Peterson, although I don't think that they actually saved any money with him. But he was a kind of blah pick, and they had their eye on someone else, and they were able to get both of those guys. So, you know, the process, in the end, everything works out. All right, well, speaking of working out, let's go to 2018, and the Mets pick Jared Kelenic, and I think that that was the right choice.
Yes.
Yeah, like basically all of the really high-end college players were picked 1 through 5. Yep. I personally liked India a lot, Jonathan India, who went at number 5. So like when all the college good college players are gone, typically the goal should be to get whoever the best prep is.
Yep.
And I think Kelenic is pretty clearly the best prep hitter.
Yeah, it's important to note, I guess, that the Mets picked 6 here. And in majority of the years prior, they're usually picking like around 15, you know, like 15 to 20-ish, whatever. So the Mets were in the top tier of talent at this point.
Yep.
Hoping that Madrigal might fall to them. But since that didn't happen, I didn't really love Bohm or India, honestly. And obviously neither of them made it there either. So Kelenic was the correct choice, I think. Now, this is also the toughest draft to evaluate right now because we have 1 year worth
of data. Yeah, very little data.
Right.
I also like Nolan Gorman a lot. Basically, it was between the two of them as, you know, who's going to be the best prep hitter out of this class. But and I prepared a little thing. Basically, Gorman had the better year post-draft where he, you know, destroyed the Appy League and ended up in the Sally League, even though he was probably not ready for the Sally League as a, I think, 18-year-old.
Yeah.
Hit a ton of power, but a ton of Ks, close to 40% in the Sally, whereas and then kind of struggled in the Appy. But as we know, evaluating guys in their draft years is very difficult.
Are you telling me that the Mets didn't promote someone when they probably should have, Ken?
Oh, yeah. Kelenic hit 413, 451, 609 for the GCL Mets.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Shocked.
No, shocked, I tell you.
Well, not that shocked.
Yeah. Basically, this year, they've kind of flipped. Gorman's, they've both been very good, but Kelenic, at time of recording, is hitting 301, 394, 545, as literally anybody on Mets Twitter can tell you. they've basically hit for the same, similar, like, I think Gorman has one additional home run. He walks a little bit less, strikes out a little bit less, but all within the fudge factor. I don't know. Kelenic's very good.
Kelenic also has a nice weighted runs created of 169. So
very nice.
Mets lost.
He also plays up the middle for now. So
Mets lost the trade. They lost the trade, everyone.
Oh, no. RIP our mentions.
Oh, boy.
Well, yeah, that was fun, kind of.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, this is a surprisingly positive review of the Mets drafts.
Yeah, the thing that they hit well with Conforto, and then they hit well with Kelenic, and just in those years between, and obviously they didn't have anybody in 2015, but in, you know, 2016, 2017, it's not like they just whiffed. You know, they made solid picks. Nobody has really shown themselves to be heads or tails better than who the Mets picked. And, you know, that's reassuring, I guess, that they're not really missing in the first round.
We're now far enough removed from the early 2010s that when we do these shows, we don't have to talk about the Dominic Smith and Gavin Cecchini picks, which would it be as glowing in terms of our review?
No, not not good.
Not great, Bob.
That's speaking of our mentions, Dom Smith.
Oh no! What have I done?
No.
The Dom Smith crew on Twitter.com.
I'm going to go ahead and say that we should never mention the Dom Smith stand squad.
Well, we just did.
Yeah. Never again.
Where's but in the a Gavin Cecchini in a mocking stand way. Squad at this point?
I mean, it's just Sam NY, right?
To be clear, I don't follow like anybody on Twitter, really. I have no clue who any of these people are. I don't really know what they say.
But, yeah, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
Beyonce, Ariana Grande, and Drake are talked about ad nauseum as celebrities, but there's one thing that's rarely discussed, their music.
On Switched on Pop, we go deep into the sounds of pop music to explain what it means, how it's made, and why it's so effective.
We talk with some of today's greatest artists, producers, and journalists to decode the musical logic behind our modern soundtrack and understand its role in our culture.
Switched on Pop will reveal for you how a secretive Swedish producer is behind many of the top 10 hits of the past 20 years.
And we'll uncover the ways that songwriters embed their political activism into today's most popular tracks.
We'll show you the surprising musical similarities between Cardi B and Taylor Swift.
And we'll even dive into the classical past to hear how the Jonas Brothers mirror Mozart's youthful party days.
I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Join us on a journey through the world of popular music by subscribing to Switched on Pop on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app to get new episodes every Tuesday.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
That ends our draft review segment and brings us to Oh Yeah, That Guy, where we take a look back and remember some of the Mets minor leaguers from yesteryear that we probably have forgotten about. So who wants to go first? All right, I will go first. On May 25th, 2013, versus the Bradenton Marauders, Angel Angel Kwan threw 7 innings, allowing 2 hits, walking none, and striking out 9. Plus, he uncorked a wild pitch and hit a guy. So, 7 innings of 9 strikeouts, pretty good. And for those of you who don't remember, Angel Kwan signed with the Mets as an 18-year-old out of Panama in September 2007. And then he started his professional career off in the He started his professional career off with the VSL Mets in 2008. VSL, not DSL. The VSL was an alternative to the DSL in Venezuela that a lot of teams had teams in until 2015 when the league folded. So Mets had a team there from 2005 to 2009. So he came stateside in 2009. He played for Kingsport in Brooklyn, and he wasn't really that great. He combined to post a 5.05 ERA over 67.2 innings, most of them coming at Kingsport. Then he spent most of 2010 in Brooklyn, and the New York Penn League made him look like money, and he posted a 2.03 ERA there, which is good for third best in the entire league among qualified starters. He went to Savannah in 2011 and was with St. Lucie in 2012, and he wasn't really that bad, but he wasn't really anything good either. He spent 2013 and 2014 bouncing up and down between St. Lucie and Binghamton, getting older and getting progressively worse, because AA was exposing him. A knee injury that he had in June 2014 didn't help, but his upside was pretty limited to begin with. And then at the end of the season, the Mets released him, and that was the end of Angel Kwan. And the biggest knock on him basically was his size and lack of stuff. He was 5'11", 150 pounds. So that's really small then for a pitcher. The fastball was bad even for a left-hander. It basically sat in the mid to high 80s, like 85 to 89. And then his secondary pitches were kind of fringe to average. He threw a curveball and a changeup. So without a decent fastball, he basically had, you know, secondary breaking balls that just kind of flashed okay. And when you don't have plus secondary stuff to thrive as like a junk bowler, you know, you don't really have a chance. And Kwan did not. So that is the tale of Angel Kwan.
That's another sad, sad tale of minor leaguers gone by.
Yep.
I have a similar one for this week's. On May 26, 2014, for Binghamton, Darren Gorski, a left-handed pitcher out of Kutztown, University of Kutztown, I guess, University of Pennsylvania, Kutztown, threw a complete game shutout with 9 innings of allowing just 2 hits and 1 walk and striking out 6. Pretty good day. Yeah, he was a 7th-round pick of the Mets in the 2009 draft. And generally spent most of his time in the organization shuffling between Binghamton and Las Vegas, depending on who needed an arm at any given time. He was in the organization for about 7 years until he left via minor league free agency following the 2015 season. Was briefly in the Nats organization before being released towards the end of spring training, and then ended up pitching for the Somerset Patriots, who are based about 4 or 5 miles from my house. Before the Mets picked him up at the end of that season too, needing, you know, extra arms for AAA, and he pitched pretty terribly in Vegas down the stretch in 2016, throwing 5.9 ERA over 68.2 innings and 53 Ks against 29 walks. So yeah, not great, but not terrible for an indie ball find. And as far as I know, he pitched a little bit in 2017 for the Royals' AA affiliate and hasn't been heard from since. So,
disappearing into the night.
Yep. Wherever you are, we wish good things for you, Darren.
Yeah, he was a favorite of Amazing Avenue Audio.
Yeah. For a while.
Yep.
There were some lean years there for a while.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The guy I picked was a similar timeline. That would be Zach Lutz. He was picked in the 5th round of the 2007 draft. 29th pick of the 5th round, so that's 183 overall. He was picked as a college bat, but didn't move particularly fast. Bounced around in low A and advanced A for the first 2 years of his career. Never really succeeded at AAA at any point outside of Vegas. He did get a brief cup of coffee with the Mets in 2012 and then a slightly longer one in 2013. His 2013 appearance was actually pretty great. He hit 300, 462, 400 in 26 plate appearances, but didn't come back after that. Stayed in the Mets system for 2 more years at AAA, just kind of kicking around. Eventually was released and went to the Marlins for a little bit before retiring after 2016. So he has a shockingly good line for his career. It's 226, 351, 290, which is doesn't sound great, but that's a 94 weighted. Never got a home run, but did get a couple hits. So he made it, which is more than a lot of people can say. The actual week I was looking at in question is 2014, between the 15th of May and the 25th of May. And I give me some leeway with the borders here. He had 349, 391, 512 with a 903 OPS and 2 dongs. So a nice week to 10 days for Mr. Lutz at AAA.
Yep. He was a guy.
Yeah.
A highly rated guy in the turn of the 2010s.
Yep.
High on a lot of prospect lists. Just didn't really pan out.
Nope. I mean, I wrote about this. I'm also pretty sure I've mentioned writing about this in the past, but I wrote about this with Drew Gagneau's write-up last season, or his season in review, like the fact that he finally made it. And I think all of us can appreciate the guys who, even if they weren't very good, stuck around in the minors for 8 years or 9 years, but got to the majors at some point. Like, There's some romantic element of baseball about that.
Yeah, exactly. You're basically like, it's something that will be on your resume forever, and like, it's proof that you're one of the, say, 300 best players in the world at any given time.
Yeah.
Or at that point in time. So. Good job, Zach.
Yep. Yeah, you frame that baseball card. You collect that, you know, health insurance, and you hold on to those memories.
Yep.
Because God knows the kind of garbage that minor league players have to go through to get to that point. And especially the ones that are older and then have to start weighing the choices between do they give up the dream, give up the hunt, and, you know, get a real job and have to support, you know, their growing families or whatever, or keep going. So for anyone to make it.
And doing this while playing, what, 40 or 50 games a year in Vegas during the summer?
Right.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, depressing place to be.
Game start at 7:10 and it's 110 degrees out.
My God. I don't think I'd make it.
No.
Because I'm not a baseball player, but if I was, I would not make it.
I'm entirely too pale for
I would tan. I just can't stand the heat.
No, I go straight to burning.
All right, well, if anybody has any questions, comments, send us an email at our email address, fromcomplextoqueens@gmail.com. You could follow us on Twitter, shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Sipa, Lucas is at ElvLaHost343, and Ken is at Ken1191. You can even friend us on Facebook, why not? And subscribe to the podcast, rate it, review it, leave comments on whatever platform you're using to do those things. And thank you everybody for listening. And we will be back next week with another review of the Mets minor league season.